This is Larry Meyer speaking from London. It was tough. It was really brutal. I'm speaking now about the invasion of France, as I saw it and as everybody else described it. Yesterday, I was on the American beachhead in Normandy, where I saw our boys as they fought and fell and advanced up the cliffs and river valleys far south of the valley of the Seine River. There is no point in giving the impression that American troops are so superior that they just battled their way past mediocre opposition deep into France. The opposition was terrific. Our losses were many. We expected that. To look at it, up there on the beaches of Normandy, the picture was pretty grim. But that is a price that was expected. And so far as we have been able to learn tonight, casualties have been lower than anticipated. I went to one of the toughest beaches with one of the earliest waves on the very first landings yesterday. The fact that it was one of the hardest beaches to crack was not of my choosing. The Germans were the ones who decided that. The early morning had been filled with drama and, literally, with fireworks. The inferno broke loose when hundreds of our planes began plastering the beaches and strafing German positions. Then our big battle wagons opened fire on the casemates and pillboxes that studded the cliffs above the shell and sand beaches. I was on what is known as an APA, or assault transport. She is a 10,000-ton ship, as young as ships go, as the troops aboard her were young, as boys go. She is the Charles Carroll, well named after the man who so boldly signed the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll of Carrollton. The Charles Carroll is mothership for a sizable brood of LCVPs, vehicle and personnel landing craft. She sailed in close to the German-held beaches, swung the landing craft overside, and filled each barge with a force of eager fighting men. When D-Day was over, there were two major questions everybody wanted answered. Were the Germans taken by surprise? And where in the world was the Luftwaffe? We set sail from a British port the evening before. A big fleet moved out in broad daylight. The sky was overcast, but there was nothing to keep the German reconnaissance planes from sweeping in under the clouds. The sky remained cloudy all night, but there was a moon whose beams penetrated the overcast, and still there was no reaction from the Nazis. It was not until our fleet of landing ships and mother ships took up position off the invasion coast of France, and the Allied Air Force and the battle wagons opened up, that the Germans showed any signs of reaction. I have discussed this phenomenon with many other war correspondents and military and naval officers, and the general agreement is that the Germans really were caught cold. The first sign of a retort was a series of fireworks from the French invasion coast between the Cherbourg Peninsula and Le Havre, northwest of Caen. There were white chandelier flares in Akkak, bursting red in the sky. There were blue and red flares that seemed to hang for minutes. And finally there was gunfire from machine guns and heavy batteries. But the Germans were late in their retort, and never did Hermann Göring's vaunted Air Force appear. I did not see a single German plane in the first 2 days of the operation. H hour came at 6:40 a.m. That's 12:40 a.m. Eastern Wartime, Tuesday, June 6th. At that hour, the first wave of American foot soldiers landed on the beaches. Authorities on the science of warfare will tell you that it is virtually impossible completely to soften up an objective by bombing and shellfire. That is why the first morning on the sands of Normandy was an inferno for our boys. On the night of D-Day, I was talking with a wounded chap from Michigan. He said, I went in with the first wave at Salerno. I went in with the eighth wave here. Boy, they claimed that Salerno was rugged, but the eighth wave in Normandy was 10 times worse than the first wave at Salerno. The path of our little troop-carrying barges lay along a channel that had been swept clear of mines during the night. The boundaries of the mine-free channel were marked with buoys on which fluttered green flags, which gave the bizarre impression that we were traveling along a Gulf fairway and not the road to one of the bloodiest battles of the war. What a thrilling and dramatic sight it was to see the scores of landing boats bobbing along over the rough channel. They were so small, Yet they seemed inexorable in their determination to get to those beaches in spite of the German fire that already was coming towards them. Other craft came too. Ducks, those troop-carrying trucks that travel on sea or land. Tank carriers, truck barges, and some secret but highly effective equipment. I watched the faces of the soldiers as the outline of the coast grew clearer. They could see not only our shells bursting, but they could see plenty of German shells exploding on the beaches and in the water around the landing craft. They could see the red and blue of tracer bullets, and they watched them skip fantastically when they hit the surface of the water. These were the boys who were joking and indulging in horseplay the night before. These were the boys who were still joking and smiling when they clambered aboard the LCVPs in the cloud-obscured moonlight. It cannot be denied that as the beaches drew nearer and the shells came dangerously close to us, the soldiers grew more somber. It was well that they should become serious, for theirs was a grim task. How grim it was could be attested to by the many wounded who were taken aboard our mother ship later. Now the preceding wave had landed and fought its way up through the surf. Now the beach was within a few hundred yards of us. Machine gun bullets cut across our bows. 88 millimeter guns, those vicious weapons the Germans used so effectively at Salerno, spread destruction on the sands and in the water. Beach obstacles stove in our landing craft. The sand under the water was studded with those beach barriers. They are of all sizes and shapes. The best known being the hedgehog, which looks something like a giant child's jack made out of steel rails. They are placed so that they will smash holes in the bottoms of our ships. They succeeded in many cases. That, too, was to be expected. We expected losses in craft as well as we expected many casualties. That, again, was the price of starting the French front. We achieved success beyond our hopes in some places. We did not do quite what we planned in others. It is impossible to give an overall picture at this point, but it is my impression that our losses in personnel and material have not been unduly large. Weather did not help any. The English Channel lived up to its tradition of roughness. The landing craft, almost flat-bottomed, pitched and tossed and bounced on their way to the beaches until many of the boys were seasick. All of us were soaked to the skin, for the waves constantly poured in giant cascades over the sides of the LCVPs. What an ordeal to be deathly ill from seasickness, then have to face heavy enemy fire. Being sodden wet didn't make much difference, for when the ramps were lowered and the boys got off the barges, they had to wade waist-deep through a rolling surf to get to beach positions. I remember one chap who preferred to face the Germans in the anger of the sea. When our barge grounded, with the machine gun and mortar fire all around, it seemed to this fellow that the ramp was slow in getting down. "Let me out of here," he yelled. "This water is getting me down." We plowed through the surf and fell on the beach. The sands were olive-colored, with masses of American soldiers. Every once in a while, an officer or a non-com would wave, and a little group would call for shooting. These soldiers were well-trained, but untried in battle. They fought against veteran German troops, against defenses of fantastic strength and ingenuity, and won and held their initial objective. Here below little villages where French and English holidaymakers used to spend their summer vacations, the Americans were under incessant shell fire. As some of the Americans worked their way up the bluffs or river valleys, succeeding waves kept pouring in. And all the while, the casualties were borne away. Still, even after the first waves landed, our battle wagons pounded away. The old battleship Texas, with her 10 14-inch guns, to the left of us. The equally old Arkansas, and the cruiser Augusta, to the right of us, with some British and French warships on either side. You could see the red flash and black smoke of their broadsides. Then you could hear the roar and feel a concussion, and finally see the shells dropping on German positions back of the beachheads. There is a rivulet that breaks through the cliffs and causes a little valley leading down to the sea at the beach where I landed. In the valley and along the shore are a few houses, usually let out to holidaymakers in the summer. Some of those houses now are fortified. Most of them, however, have been demolished by our fire.
Our troops had to fight their way into the valley and up the steep bluffs, past barricades of every description, including barbed wire, roadblocks, pillboxes, and landmines. They were succeeding when I left the beach, in spite of the fact that our bombs and gunfire had not succeeded in knocking out all the batteries, nor had the Rangers, who went in earlier, been able to get at all the German gun emplacements. There was one particularly troublesome Nazi 88, just east of the beach where I landed. He fired at the rate of 12 to 15 rounds a minute, did a lot of damage on the beach, and wrecked at least two tank landing craft. Finally, we got him, too. Towards afternoon, another big tidal wave of American reinforcements arrived, bringing encouragement and respite to the boys who had established the first bridgehead in the invasion of France. With them went the famous combat engineers. Many a vehicle was lost in the landing, tanks and ducks and half-tracks, but most were landed. And within a matter of minutes after the eighth wave landed, the engineers had roads running across and up and down the beach. Last night, as I returned to a South British port on the mothership, I saw one of the most amazing sights of my life. The officers' wardroom was crowded with tired officers having their evening meal. But there was not enough operating tables on the ship. So tables in the wardroom were used for operations and for giving blood plasma, while the evening meal went on. And today at the same South British port, I saw scores of two-engine planes towing gliders across the channel, and soon afterwards saw them come back without the gliders. Tonight's newspapers say that the glider attack was a success. And still no Luftwaffe. We expected a German air attack on our ships last night as we came home. Our fleet would have made an easy target. Where was the Luftwaffe? There was further encouragement in the drive up to London. The big parade is on. Roads were jammed with the lifeblood of war. More men and material than Hitler ever dreamed of are on their way to back up that hard-won beachhead. This is Larry Meyer, representing the Combined American Networks. I now return you to the United States.